What are museums for? Whose stories do they tell? How do they decide which aspects of the past to preserve and represent?
I'm Luke Syson, Director of the Fitzwilliam Museum at the University of Cambridge.
And I'm Nicola Jennings, Director of the Athena Art Foundation.
And over the course of 6 conversations, we're inviting a range of cultural figures, from directors and curators and researchers to activists and writers, to share their thoughts on the role of the museum in the 21st century.
We'll be looking at the modern museum through a variety of lenses, exploring some of the key questions museums around the world are currently asking themselves. How can museums represent the diverse communities they serve? To whom do cultural artifacts and their narratives belong? What role can digital technologies play? How can museums work sustainably to preserve our futures as well as our pasts?
This podcast series is a Fitzwilliam Museum, Carnegie Foundation, and Athena Art Foundation co-production. As a curator of post-medieval Western art, I used to feel myself largely an onlooker in the debate that's now raged for many decades around restitution, repatriation, and so on of objects, feeling that it largely concerned other disciplines and directly involved only when objects had been subject to Nazi spoliation. Now I think it's an issue that concerns us all in the UK and globally, key to our own nation histories and to our relationships with the rest of the world. And of course, the subject of the Benin bronzes in particular has been explored in 2 recent books. I was recently a much more engaged witness when Jesus College returned the Benin cockerel to Nigeria. Now feels like a particularly useful moment to discover more from the perspective of 2 people who've long been engaged in this area of work.
We are delighted today to have Dr. Donna Yates, an Associate Professor of Criminal Law and Criminology at Maastricht University, having done a PhD in archaeology at the University of Cambridge. Donna studies the global illicit trafficking of cultural objects and is a member of the Trafficking Culture Research Consortium. Professor Nicholas Thomas has been Director of the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology at the University of Cambridge and a Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, since 2006. He was co-curator of the 2018 Oceania exhibition for the Royal Academy and is the author of several influential books on material culture and indigenous art and colonial culture in the Pacific. I'll start with Nick. We've talked in previous episodes about the need for museums to reflect more diverse society. How does restitution sit with that and with the broader drive to understand all world cultures in all parts of the world?
The question of where artifacts, artworks, and collections belong is enormously important. It's a focal question of heritage justice, but it's also probably the cultural issue that's represented most reductively in the media. It's understood as a zero-sum game, that is, some people have got it, other people haven't, and it's represented in a sense as a global issue. Should cultural treasures be returned? The problem is first that there are many ways of making collections and artifacts accessible. There are many trajectories and destinations that they can have. The question of which organisation, which government owns them isn't the same as the question of where they may be located or how they may be circulated. The issue of should material be returned is not a single question. It's a question that is mind-bogglingly heterogeneous. The more you talk to people who have interests in the issue, whether they're in European museums or in communities in Africa or governments in Asia, the stronger a sense you have that this is not the same issue in every case. Contrary to the way the issue is represented in the media, there are an awful lot of people in the countries from which collections originated that are not supportive of the return for a variety of reasons.
Donna, I think you study these things in a slightly more contemporary focus, things that have been stolen more recently.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking about how restitution sits with dealing with more contemporary movements of cultural objects, it kind of moves into a different area of complexity. Because when you're talking about activities that you can easily define as crimes under existing criminal law, your complexities then come out of what law applies where? How far can the law go? How should the law be interpreted? So thinking about the question of how does restitution sit with the broader desire to understand all world cultures in all parts of the world, I think that's an interesting question because the concept of restitution forces us to really deal with the legal and social complexities that not everybody uses these objects in the same way, not everybody experiences them in the same way, and not everybody wants the same and present futures for these objects. So restitution becomes this big multi-sided discussion that doesn't necessarily result in a happy result for anybody.
Can I push you though both a little on this, perhaps starting with Nick? One of the tensions it seems to me here is between a respect for the creators of works of art, of artifacts, and an acknowledgement that there has now been enormous migration across the world for a range of different reasons, and that therefore there are diaspora communities whose sense of themselves sometimes depends on being able to see those objects in the part of the world that they've adopted as their home. Is this one of the key things that makes this matter so much?
I think not only migration makes it enormously important that museums in North America or Europe are cosmopolitan. We are all what some people refer to as post-migrant societies. That is, migrants are, in a sense, permanently and irreducibly part of the population of our societies. And of course, in Britain, we could start talking about Huguenots or various blacks in the 18th century. That makes it fundamentally necessary that museums of culture and history and art are globally representative. And my sense, talking to people in, for example, Fiji, or for that matter, Nigeria, is that while there are all sorts of views about what we might call expatriate heritage, there's also a certain amount of pride that there are these great museums and Fiji is represented. It makes the institution a place they can connect with. Occasionally we get research visitors coming and saying, you know, how come you got nothing from my community? I mean, that's a source of grievance to them. It's a delicate point. The Oba of Benin was Nigerian ambassador to Sweden and Italy and has a deep awareness of what museums do, the value of museums in Europe. And what he stressed to me is that some of it must come back. But the sum is important because he's well aware that Benin's civilization is deservedly recognized for its artistic achievements via the displays in a variety of museums. There are contexts where government ministers will say all of it must come back, but I think that is actually above all a political statement rather than what most people involved in education, culture, and related fields in those communities think. They may in some cases be very anxious that specific pieces, some of the masterpieces, are physically returned. But in my experience, many of those people are concerned that their traditions continue to be represented, not only for the diaspora, but for wider populations in Europe and elsewhere.
Yeah, so in a sense, I'm thankful, again, that I work with recently stolen material because the ability to fall back on the law as justification for the return of cultural objects makes things really easy, so to speak. Other arguments, you can argue about that all day, but the law was broken. We have to follow the law. But then you move to this vast multi-century history about the movement of cultural objects and the difficulties in untangling the stories of their movement, the legal situations in which they were moved. And then as Nick was talking about, wherever they've ended up, it's very complicated. You asked, is that why it matters? I'm not sure if that's exactly why it matters, but one thing that does matter is indeed having those discussions about the needs of contemporary diaspora communities and what the placement of an object in a museum in the UK versus a museum wherever else means, and what is lost if it's not back where it was originally made? What's lost if it's not left where it's ended up? What stories can be told around those? So I suppose I kind of think what matters is having that discussion and letting it be a discussion, because in a sense, in the past, these weren't necessarily discussions that anyone was having.
But ownership matters as well, doesn't it, when we get down to politics? What I think the French are doing is they are saying, okay, we will give you back the objects, but we'll keep them here for 25 years and display them here.
Well, the French have also had instances where, because of how the French define what their national heritage is, they've actually returned objects and retained ownership of them. For example, there's a group of Korean royal books that were taken during points of conflict, spoils of war. France did return them, but technically they remain French property. They're just on permanent forever loan to South Korea that seemed to make South Korea happy. These aren't necessarily models. They're almost like pragmatic solutions within the frameworks that exist.
Just to add that I think while for many diasporic communities, the capacity to engage with material in major museums in the cities that they live in, whether that's in Germany or Britain, is really, really important. We have to be clear that we're not using the diaspora as a sort of excuse for retention in the way that earlier museum directors used the Universal Museum as a reason why nothing could be returned. And unfortunately, that led to the idea of the Universal Museum, very wide-ranging, culturally representative collection, being thoroughly discredited. If we feel that there are reasons why an object should not be returned, we have to be absolutely upfront and honest about those reasons.
Nick, could you give us a quick introduction to the Benin issue? We've heard a lot about the Benin bronzes in the press, but perhaps not everybody knows exactly what the heart of the issue is.
The shortest possible version of it is that, as in many other colonial theatres, there were conflicts about trade. The British were very anxious to secure the capacity to trade in what's now Edo State, southern Nigeria. They were, in effect, trying to impose that arrangement on the royal court in Benin City. They sent a party to open negotiations and were explicitly advised that it was the wrong time. They ignored that advice and the group were attacked and killed. That justified a punitive expedition that took place in February 1897. The city was sacked, the Oba was deported, and thousands of artifacts that are actually brass but are always referred to as the Benin bronzes, as well as royal ivories and a whole range of other artifacts, some thousands in number, were taken away, mainly, so to speak, as official loot on the property of the British government. A good deal was taken away privately by individual officers. The official part of the loot was auctioned to cover the costs of the invasion. At that time, German anthropological museums were rather better funded than British ones, so a good deal of material went to Germany. The largest single collection is in the British Museum, but pieces are dispersed literally all over the world in many regional museums in the UK. I was at Fries Masters a couple of years ago and a London dealer was selling a piece, and very understandably, the court of Benin, the descendants of the people from whom the objects were taken away, have felt very deeply that they want to recover that heritage of their family. The issue has been significant within Nigeria, across Africa, as a sort of hallmark of the looting of African heritage. And it's also been important in a way in Britain, in the history of anti-racist movements, the questioning of British colonial power. We at MAA are fortunate to have in the collection a group of remarkable prints by a black British artist named Tony Phillips, who made a series of etchings in 1984 about the history of the bronzes. So this is a debate that has really been around for a long time. Finally, there is significant momentum, which is wonderful.
And Nick, can you tell us As the director of MAA, the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, what's the policy here in Cambridge and how does that relate to what's happening in other collections, both in the UK and elsewhere?
The policy has evolved, and I guess you could say we didn't develop or advance it faster because we had never actually received a claim or a request. I suppose a side issue is, do museums always have to be reactive? Do we have to wait for a claim? Or where we're aware of significant contentious material in our own collections, would it be more positive if we started the discussion? Together with other Cambridge museums, we looked at questions about a returns policy. A few years ago, we arrived at a framework which attempts to be nuanced. It cites questions of acquisition, where material was looted or inappropriately acquired or sold to a collector by someone who wasn't entitled to sell it. Those are clearly criteria that support a case for return. It's not exactly a commitment because everything is case by case, but we are open to claims in relation to secret sacred material that may have in some sense been acquired legitimately in the context of the period, but which it's now agreed would be completely inappropriate to display or publish or make accessible to researchers other than people who have the specific authority of the Indigenous community. I think the most important aspect of the policy is that we're open to discussion and receptive to claims. In the case of Benin, given the momentum around the discussion, it seemed right that we should signal that any proposal to return material would be fully consistent with the policy that MAA and the University of Cambridge Museums has adopted. We're at very preliminary stages, but we've started a discussion with the National Commission for Museums and Monuments. That's the federal government of Nigeria's Agency for Heritage and Museums. Their sense is that it is really important that we take steps to return legal ownership to Nigeria. And my sense is that the university community would consider that an appropriate path to go down, and that people on our governing bodies and other key figures in the university would support that approach. They've also said that legal ownership is one thing and physical location is another. No doubt, as the Edo Museum of West African Arts, which is being designed by David Ajaye, and other facilities develop in Benin City, they will need material from our collection. But the expectation is that other material might remain on display at MAA on a loan basis. And it was really interesting talking to the prince who was through recently and the NCMM staff about the fact that Benin is a focus for a primary school module in the English primary education curriculum. We therefore host a lot of school groups in front of those cases. They were really gratified to hear that, and I think would hope that we can continue to do that. It's an evolving thing, not a one-off decision, and certainly not a zero-sum game.
Donna, the argument is sort of polarised between people who feel that the circumstances for collecting in a colonial context were always such that the power relationships were unequal, that the transactions were therefore tainted, and there is no argument for retaining. And the people, on the other hand, who say, but where would it end? Isn't this the floodgates? Wouldn't museums just empty? Can you talk a little bit about where you see that process of moving beyond the examples where theft can be clearly demonstrated, that question of unequal power?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that speaks to something that Nick just said that I think is very important, that when it comes to contemporary discussions towards the restitution or return of cultural objects, it is not necessarily the case that the claimants, the people asking for this return, need or even want the physical object. Sometimes the return of ownership and thus that amount of power in the relationship is what's desired and what's needed. did. So just returning the ability to decide what happens to this object is what's needed, because it is this change in the power imbalance. I think the people who use this floodgate excuse, I will speculate that it's done a bit flippantly and often without a lot of deeply considered nuance, as kind of an excuse for not fully engaging with the issue or the process or the potential outcomes, because there are so many different alternatives for restitution in quotation marks than simply floodgates open, you know, British Museum's vacant, there's nothing there. Possibilities again for transferring ownership and not the object, possibilities for sharing the object in different ways, returning one object but securing the long-term loan of 50 more interesting or different objects. I do like that you mentioned the word power, because I think that the real goal perhaps in restitution discussions should be not necessarily that all power shifts, but that communities that were historically powerless don't have less power anymore.
May I ask a question coming back to what Nick was saying, and also connecting to what Donna was saying, is that listening to you talk, Nick, it sounded to me as if really you're on your own. There doesn't seem to be much of a legal framework in the UK.
The legislation that blocks national museums in England, not Scotland or the other devolved nations, incidentally, only applies to the national museums. It doesn't apply to local authority museums or to university museums. What I'd say, though, is that we're not being left on our own in the sense that there's a huge amount of rewarding discussion among curators with people in the nations concerned about how this might evolve, what the best outcomes are. Perhaps most importantly, the question shifting, it's not should it happen, it's how do we make a success of it. The Arts Council of England has been working towards new guidance around returning cultural heritage. The new framework will replace documents published as long ago as 2000. So clearly it's overdue and somewhat urgent that there is some guidance that supports especially curators and decision makers, trustees in smaller museums. It's only guidance, it's not legal. Institutions have different governance frameworks, and we'll also have to make decisions that really reflect the specific histories and contexts of the pieces that are at issue.
Yeah, so following on from that, when we're talking about the legal aspects of restitution and return, when it comes to objects that were moved out of their original context a significant time ago, we rarely see legal cases made for return because applying the laws of the distant past doesn't play out well in court, and it's usually not attempted because it doesn't really go anywhere. Most legal cases, when we talk about the return of cultural objects, relate to recent looting and recent trafficking, where more contemporary laws in place. The legal things we tend to see are legal barriers within countries that prevent the return of cultural objects from certain institutions or under certain circumstances. And there are some places where those, if they exist, are being changed or discussed. That leaves the question of what kind of frameworks exist. As was mentioned, there's some frameworks being developed in the UK. This is an extremely hot point of discussion in the Netherlands and Belgium, where there's a process going on about guidelines for return and the level of investigation that will be done in nationally held collections. And there's a large discussion happening in Germany as well. So I think that these kind of frameworks are starting to emerge. It's the hot talk of the museum world, I think, right now.
Yeah, and there have been accusations of double standards, haven't there, too, when exceptions have been made for objects looted by the Nazis being returned from collections, which statutes say we can never return any objects.
Yeah. But again, in many of the cases where the statutes say that they can never return any objects, the exception is if these objects are absolutely positively shown to be stolen. If the British Museum is found to have something that was stolen from me yesterday, yes, the British Museum can return that thing to me. That tends to be the exception there. And again, we're talking about a more contemporary event with an easier to interpret legal landscape, easier than dealing with Ottoman law, for example.
Donna, Nick, I want to push you a little bit more on that. I used to work at the British Museum nearly 30 years ago. A distinction was made between those objects that were demonstrably stolen from the Jewish populations of Europe and those that were demonstrably stolen from the people of Benin. And that was about time. There was a sense that one had resonance today and the other perhaps less so. Now, I think arguably we're learning and have learned since then and that that's not true. One case that's often made by people who don't want to return objects to countries is that there should be some sort of statute of limitations, maybe 100 years or 150 years and so on. I just wonder from the point of view of balancing the moral and the legal, how you feel about that. And perhaps also the British Museum is once again saying that the Parthenon marbles were acquired legally, they were bought. But again, the question of whether the law that applied 200 years ago should matter as much as it does. Should there be a statute of limitations on what's considered to have been a legal transaction at that moment?
You can probably tell by my accent that I'm an American. And though in the United States and a lot of jurisdictions, we do have statutes of limitations for the claiming of stolen goods, we don't actually have a concept of a good faith purchaser. So a stolen item, even a stolen item purchased in good faith or acquired in good faith, the purchaser doesn't gain good title to it because a crime is always a crime. Someone has always been aggrieved when this thing was stolen. And that's kind of how I approach statutes of limitations in this area, by saying because this happened 150 years ago doesn't make it any less a crime, doesn't make an item any less stolen, again, depending on the laws in question. And when we apply statutes of limitation to cultural objects, we get into really difficult scenarios. To think of one particular scenario at a museum that will remain nameless, there's a collection of Maya artifacts that Guatemala started the process of having returned. And then the horrors of the Guatemalan Civil War intervene. So when they got back on track to continue this process, as it turned out, because they had initially requested it, the statute of limitations had run out within the particular state in question. That meant that to this day, Guatemala doesn't have its cultural objects. Statutes of limitation absolutely only benefit one side. They're usually in place to encourage people who've lost stolen property to not wait around to claim it. I just don't think that that's appropriate for this kind of thing. Cultural objects that are so absolutely socially and culturally and religiously significant. You're thinking of an item that is a god, like an actual god, saying there's a statute of limitations for claiming a god that has personhood and agency is ridiculous. That's like saying there's a statute of limitations for claiming back a kidnapped child. I'm speaking entirely personally here, but I think that statutes of limitation in this area excuse people from having difficult discussions that need to take place.
A colleague of mine from the Pacific said, for us, the past is not so long ago. And of course, that raises the question of what might be meaningful time frames. I think there are some incredibly difficult issues, even as there's a great deal of momentum processes in the Netherlands, Germany and Belgium. There are some really fundamental questions that have not been tackled or adequately worked through, such as in the Netherlands and in a number of other contexts, the focus is very much on state-to-state negotiation. So in the colonial context, material should be returned to national governments. And there may be many contexts where that is unambiguously the right way to do it. But it seems a problem if that's the only way the system could work, if that means that at a certain point a European museum might return material from Tibet to Beijing, or material from Sulawesi or somewhere else in eastern Indonesia to Jakarta.
The next question then is really, so how much is it the business of the current owner to determine what happens to an object once it's returned to its country of origin? How much can we take those decisions?
That question arises virtually all the time. And I think it's one of the issues where the sort of rhetoric about heritage justice in the media sort of sees the outside of the debate, but not the inside of the debate. And there are many contexts where repatriation claims get worked through very slowly by museums because it's not at all clear that the people making the claim blame are the people who have the most recognition and support locally. In New Zealand and Australia, for example, there are constituted bodies, tribal councils and equivalent organisations that are essentially the only organisations that should legitimately be making claim. But claims may often be submitted by individuals or families or rival groups, and in general have little capacity to adjudicate those issues unless they have very strong local contacts and are committed to undertaking the research. If there is a clear lack of alignment or contest going on between parties, it's very difficult to do anything other than pause the request until those issues have been very clearly resolved locally.
I'm conscious that in finishing this conversation, we're very much talking from the point of view of four people operating in Europe, in the museum world, in academia, with the perspectives of those who've grown up in museums in Australia, in North America, and Europe, all of us white. We're all, I think, fairly agreed about the need to look at these issues in as positive and receptive a way as we possibly can. So I'm wondering what we might want to put in our museums that replaces the objects that we have returned to their countries of origin, that teaches us about the rest of the world. Let's start with Donna.
Well, I like the Ghost Gent shirt that's in the Kelvin Grove Museum in Glasgow. The short version of this story is that Glasgow museums ended up with a particular type of shirt that was used in sort of a charismatic movement in the late 1800s in the United States by certain Native American groups. And what ended up happening is that this shirt was taken off of a dead body at Wounded Knee, and within a year was in the collection of Glasgow museums because it had actually come to Scotland with Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West shirt. It had holes in it, stains that could have been blood. It was pretty grisly. After a long but interesting process and discussion and public discussion with people of the city of Glasgow, the Ghost Dance shirt was returned. And one of the Lakota Sioux members who was involved in the return actually made a replacement. So made another Ghost Dance shirt that looked like this one, which is now on display in the Kelvin Grove Museum. So you have something that looks very much like the object that was there. And you have this whole story of how the object got to Glasgow and then why it was returned, which in itself is, for me, much, much richer and much more interesting than this kind of grisly, kind of horrible testament to something absolutely terrible, just kind of sitting uncontextualized in Scotland. Not every return can result in something like that, but I think that that's just an absolutely interesting example where you replace the object with another object, the same size and shape, and a whole story to go with it.
In a way, I'd query the premise that returning something leaves a gap, that repatriation's an existential threat to the museum because the collection's being taken away. In most cases, you're talking about sort of limited numbers of pieces, very limited numbers relative to the vast collections that we care for in World Cultures and Art and Antiquities museums. There are always masterpieces in storage that have been in storage forever that should be rotated onto display. But I think the strategy that Donna refers to of foregrounding the story, the history, and contemporary responses is one that a number of museums are adopting. Some of the most contentious objects in MAA, which are some spears that were taken away by Captain Cook at the time of first contact at Botany Bay in 1770, are actually now about to go on loan, being exhibited in Sydney for the first time. Even though that's actually only a short-term loan, the Gwaiagal people had arranged to lend us some spears by an elder and artist there, Rod Mason, which are essentially sort of modern reactivations of that genre, and they will be on display in Cambridge while the historic pieces are in Sydney. I think there are many things that World Cultures museums need to do. One of them, most basically, is to make the point that we're not representing the cultures of, you know, lost civilizations or people who faded away. That stereotype of the disappearing world. we have to communicate that we are representing places where all sorts of things are going on right now. And of course, there's an enormous amount of powerful contemporary art from various parts of Africa and Oceania and Native America and other regions. And if we can weave some of that material into our displays, we're creating space for Indigenous voices and local voices in a way that is hugely important.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Donna. This conversation for me has been immensely illuminating. I'm very grateful to both of you.
Yes, thank you from me too. It's been really important to be having this conversation.
This podcast series is a Fitzwilliam Museum, Colnaghi Foundation, and Athena Art Foundation co-production.